Hi, I'm Luke Dennis, the Development Director at WYSO. We are happy we can deliver these programs to you, people who listen on the web, and we rely on you to help us pay for this service. So at our website, wyso.org, click Support This Station and help keep these services coming. And thank you.
Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'd like to welcome to the program today Jocelyn Jackson. She's just published a new novel. It's called Someone Else's Love Story. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Jocelyn, where are you? Are you in Georgia?
I am in Decatur, Georgia.
Okay. Yeah, I guess I'm hearing a little bit of Georgia there. Can you amp that up a little bit?
Well, I could if you were to pour me a bourbon. Or a glass of red wine, it gets away from me. But Decatur is inside of Atlanta, so I've lost a lot of my very southern accent that I had when I was younger.
That's true. Atlanta has become kind of a metropolitan, almost a northern city. I know that's probably just, you know, scandalous for me to say that. But
Maybe a little bit scandalous.
Okay. Well, this new novel is set in that area, right?
Yes, right. My home stomping grounds.
Okay. How'd you get the idea for this? This is kind of a wacky story.
Well, the story has two narrators, and one of them, William, I had been wanting to write about for about 10 years. But at the novel's beginning, he is such a sad person. He has lost absolutely everything, and whenever I would start trying to write the William book, he would just want to walk into the sea like a lemming, and that's not a very good novel. One day, William walked into the sea, the end. So I never wrote about him, but I knew it would be a book about miracles. I knew it would be a book that was an Easter story in a way, with a virgin birth and a sacrifice and a resurrection, but I just wasn't ready to write it. Well, I started writing a book about Shandy Pierce, this young woman who lived in Dahlonega, and almost, like, I started noticing that everything I was doing with Shandy was thematically what I had wanted to do in what I was calling the William book that I couldn't write. And I thought, well, what if William is this gray rock, and what if Shandy's the hammer, and what if I just use her to smash him open and he's all up diamonds in there? And so I stopped writing the Shandy book and started Someone Else's Love Story.
So what was it about William that you'd wanted to write it, but you couldn't? What was the deal?
Well, he's a difficult character. You know, William doesn't really regret, and he doesn't really project or worry. He lives very much in the moment. He analyzes, decides, and acts. And to start him at a place where I knew he would begin in the book, from such a state of profound sadness, I couldn't find a way in to William to sort of light him up and make him accessible in a way that I could write him until I put him with Shandy.
And is that because of William's condition?
I mean, I've written about characters with who are on the autism spectrum before. William's a high functioning guy with a career, and he had a family. That's something that's interested me for a very long time. I don't think that was what made him so hard to write. The book I wrote before Gods in Alabama actually was about a therapeutic riding stable where, there were autistic children, one of whom was a main character, an adolescent, a girl named Ruthie. So that really wasn't, I felt like I had a really good handle on that. It genuinely was his sadness.
Mm-hmm. Well, William, he has, what would you call it, Asperger's?
Sure.
Okay.
They sort of changed the language around it right now, which I don't agree with, but fine.
And he's also a hunk.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a tradition in Southern Gothic literature of writing into a archetype you know, like the genteel little old lady or the Southern Belle, and then you sort of twist that, usually to make a point about social justice. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted William to be in some ways this, you know, the romance hero. You know, he's this gorgeous blonde hunk who steps in to save the day. And, of course, you know, he's also so depressed he's suicidal and on the autism spectrum. So, that is a kind of fun thing, I think.
You have a lot of surprises in this story. And, of course, one of the biggest ones is Shandy and the fact that she's a 21-year-old single mother who has experienced a virgin birth, and she's the mother of my favorite character, Natty Bumppo.
Yeah, I love Natty. I tell you what, people always ask me if my characters are based on real people, and the truth is they're not. I make them up. You know, I can see little bits or flecks of my husband or my Aunt Susie, sometimes in the same character, but they really are people that I invent. The exception is very often children, because children are so weird, it's very hard to make them up convincingly. So a lot of Natty's lines are actually things my own child said. Like at one point he says, "I am sweaty into all my hairs," or "This hill is making me exhausted." And that is just the way Sam talked. And I tried to kind of make Natty be a real 3-year-old.
Mm. Wow. We've also got a lot of very close male-female friendships. This is pure fiction, isn't it?
No, not really. I do think it's very difficult for men and women to be close friends the way these pairs of friends are. I think that very often that kind of intimacy leads other places, and once sex rears its ugly head, or the idea of sex, it's hard to put it back to bed. And I tried a lot of ways, but I wanted them to genuinely, William and Paula and Shandy and Walcott, to genuinely be pairs of male-female best friends. And what I find, the only thing that worked eventually was, before the novel starts, the two pairs have slept together. So I couldn't, like, there was always this untapped sexual tension there until I just let them all sleep together, and then at that point, I was able to write as if they were friends. It's like they had just sort of moved through that and onto something else. So there was no mystery there. I think a lot of power and attraction is in the mystery.
So you just got that right out of the way. Okay.
That's right. Checked that box, moved on. Well, that didn't work.
Yeah. The book is Someone Else's Love Story. Jocelyn Jackson wrote it. She joins us on the program today. As we're taping this interview, the book is not actually out yet, but as we're airing this interview, she will be in Dayton for a book signing. She'll be at Books & Company at the Green, and that is this Monday evening at 7 o'clock. You can meet her. She'll be there talking about Someone Else's Love Story. And she's been kind enough to join us before she goes on her crazy book tour.
Yeah, I'm excited about it. I like going on book tour.
I'll bet you do. I get the sense that you have a lot of fun with this.
I do. You know, book tour is weird. It's like agony and ecstasy. The agony is in the airports, and the ecstasy is in the bookstores with the booksellers and the readers.
Uh-huh. So how did you get into doing this? I mean, how did you get this vocation?
Oh, this is what I've always wanted to do. I've written my whole life. My mother has books that I wrote and published using the Crayola and stapler method when I was 3, 4, 5 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. I can't not do it. Even if it wasn't my job, I'm very blessed that it's my job. I'm so lucky to have a readership, but I would be writing either way.
Oh.
I wrote for years before I was publishing, so.
And you have some very creative family setups here. Obviously, a lot of these are things that aren't that uncommon now in our modern age, but once upon a time, they might have been. You've got cross religions. You've got lesbian parents. You've got all the good stuff of our modern times.
Yes, there's definitely, you know, the families that are in this book match what I see around me in my neighborhood, you know. So, I mean, that's what we look like now. We're not homogenous anymore. Boy, America as a melting pot, we just keep changing in the most interesting ways. It's very helpful if one is a novelist.
Mm. Shandy's mother, she's a piece of work.
In this world, she is a piece of work. I actually love Mimi. I wrote a the novel that I started to write before I ended up writing the William and Shandy book that was just Shandy's book. I ended up writing a novella out of some of that material in which Mimi's a much larger character. And I think she comes off better. Like, we don't see Mimi very much, and we certainly don't see Mimi at her best. But she does have a best. So that novella is called My Own Miraculous, and that is actually already out. And it's just sort of the story of Shandy and Walcott and Mimi, and how kind of it's sort of a story of how Shandy steps fully into the role of motherhood. You know, she got pregnant when she was 17. She was a mother at 18, and she tells the story of how, you know, she says, in the beginning, I wasn't really a mother. I loved my son, but I was a daughter with a child. You know, I was feeding Natty, and my mom was, and Mimi was sliding eggs and sausage onto my plate, feeding me. And it's sort of how Shandy steps into the role and actually becomes a whole mother when there's this dangerous person who gets very interested in Natty because he's so gifted and unusual a little child.
I think that current research shows that men, if they read books at all, read mostly nonfiction. Women are reading all the fiction. There's a rare guy that reads fiction. I know there's plenty of them that do. I love fiction. I'm guessing a lot of your readership is probably female. As we were going through this story, I thought to myself, okay, what character am I attracted to? And I thought, well, it's probably not a character that is commonly that attractive to a lot of your readers, but my character that I was really attracted to was your hunk's best friend.
Paula?
Yeah.
She's my favorite.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm writing a book right now where Paula is the narrator.
Yeah, she's bad.
She is so bad. She's like Batman in heels.
Yeah.
I love her.
Yeah, yeah.
I agree with you, though. She's a tough one because she's a tough character. It's certainly tough to give her her own novel when I know that reactions to her are going to be pretty extreme because she's a very extreme person. She's this very feminist, very... She loves to fight. She loves a rumble. Whatever comes, she steps right up to it, shoulder to shoulder. And, man, you better not mess with William. Ugh.
And she's a divorce lawyer, and she only represents women, even though she doesn't have a real high opinion of a lot of her clients.
No, she doesn't have a high opinion of a lot of her clients. She's kind of misleading Shandy there. She does a lot of pro bono criminal work, and that's where she only represents women. She will represent anyone she sees as the underdog in her divorce practice.
Oh.
She was a minor character, so I couldn't. You can't explain everything about the person's whole life. They light up more later if you write about them more. But yeah, she definitely. She wants to represent the underdog. She wants to stand between anyone she sees as a mouse and anyone she sees as a tiger because she loves to fight tigers.
I see. So she was feeding Shandy a bunch of stuff, and I swallowed it.
Well, I think that's fair. She's telling the truth. She just doesn't say, Shandy, let me explain how my whole life works to you. It's
right.
A toss-off sentence because they don't like each other very much. That's an understatement.
Right. Jocelyn Jackson joins us. So is that the next book, then, about her?
Yes, it's called Nobody's Nothing. It's the first time I've ever written a true sequel, and I'm having a good time with it. It's very interesting. I was so interested in this world, this area, this created space, that I wanted to stay in it. So it's called Nobody's Nothing. So it's someone else's love story, and then it's Nobody's Nothing.
So it's a true sequel to this one?
Yes.
Okay.
Paula picks it up right where this book leaves off.
Okay. What is it about Southern writers? What is it about?
I don't know. There's mental illness in the water down here. That's all I can tell you. I never knew. You know, I grew up in the South. I spent my whole life here. I never wrote about the South or was interested in writing about the South until I went to Chicago for graduate school and was like, oh, we're so weird. I mean, I didn't know. It was just like weird. You're soaking in it. It's normal.
Uh-huh.
And the way we put our crazy people right out on the front porch, this is my crazy Aunt Betty. I love that about us.
Yeah, well, I've interviewed a few writers from your area. Pat Conroy comes to mind.
He's great.
Yeah, there's just something special about Southern writers. I've never been able to figure out what it is. Well, we just had another one on the program, Tom Franklin. You familiar with him?
I love Tom Franklin. He's one of my favorite writers.
He's something.
Crooked Letter is so good.
It is.
Tilted World is so good.
Yeah.
He, I tell you what, part of it is I don't know a Southern writer that doesn't feel deeply ambivalent about their homeland. Like, you love it. I love it. I love the South. And yet I'm standing on soil that is black with blood and injustice. So I think that sort of deep-set uneasiness with loving your own home gives rise to a lot of interesting stories.
Mm. Let's talk about the defining moment in this story, someone else's love story. It's a robbery.
Yes. Yeah, this is a book at its thematic core. We're talking about miracles and fate and the way religion can be used as a weapon or a balm, depending on whose hands it's in, the misdirected power of faith and the true power of faith, you know, for good or evil, depending on how it's used. And it's a book about miracles. And so I wanted, when William and Shandy met, there had to be an element of the fantastic to it. I mean, it had to be fate. It had to be a meeting that Shandy would be able, because William thinks that destiny is a word that means coincidence or your own will. It is my destiny to do this, and therefore I will do it because I want it and I will make it happen. Not, I was fated to stumble onto this by any path, you know, by some cosmic force. William's a stone atheist and a rationalist. And of course, Shandy believes very much in destiny and miracles. And for her, William, in this robbery, to put himself between the gun and her child, that's it for her. You know, he was fated to be there, and she falls in love with him. I mean, greater love hath no man than this, that he would lay down his life for another. And William gets between a gun and her little boy, who she loves more than anything on earth. And from that moment on, she is in love with him. And I wanted there to be that element of chance, of randomness, you know, where these two people, their lives would never have crossed. The two of them are never going to go to the same Christmas party. You know, they do not run in the same circles. And at the same time, I wanted, you know, because this is a book about miracles, there's all these huge, overblown miracles in the book. I mean, there's a virgin birth, a resurrection, more than one resurrection. And all of those are fake. None of them are true. They are all explained by science. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, there's at least one, you could maybe make the case for two, tiny, quiet miracles that happen that are truly unexplainable, but they go by so fast and they're just a little ping, but they have these ripples that change everything.
Jocelyn Jackson joins us. Her novel is Someone Else's Love Story. She'll be in town for a book signing on Monday night, 7 o'clock at Books & Company in the Green. You can meet her, and she'll be signing copies of this new novel. I was very intrigued by the way that you use these different perspectives and viewpoints. We have the robbery in the Circle K. We have William's viewpoint of what's going on. We have Shandy's viewpoint of what's going on. They're very different. And then, fortunately, we also have the viewpoints of their best friends who see things and understand things about them, and that helps us to comprehend the whole thing.
Oh, good. I'm glad. I Paula and Walcott both are two. I love them. I love the role that each of them play, and I'm glad that they came through for you, because they don't have a lot of screen time, but they're key, you know? They're key relationships that sort of light up all the other relationships.
I don't want to talk about Walcott, sorry.
My floppy-haired poet. We don't have to.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about him. You could misunderstand his name, right?
Sure.
Yeah, Walcott. Walcott.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a very, you have fun with this, I can tell. I mean, you're very clever, the way that you write this.
Well, it's organic. I'm not, I don't, very little of what I do is planned. I know the characters extremely well. It's not unusual for me to think about a character for 5 or 10, or in one case, 18 years before writing about them.
Really?
Really. That's inherent to my process. I know the people very well, and I know the kind of things I want to explore with those people. Plot, I don't know. If I knew what was always going to happen, I think I would get very bored writing it, because I like a big old scoop of plot. I like things to happen, and I like to entertain myself and cackle when I think, oh, what if this, and try it and see if it flies. And as long as the people stay wholly themselves within whatever happens, I just go where it leads me and see how it plays out. But I mean, the way I write a book is I know the people really well, I know their relationships to each other, and then I sort of gather them all around a central point and light one of them on fire or more and see what they do.
So you just hop on the speeding train, you have no idea where it's going to end up.
Well, I have a thematic idea. I mean, I know what I want the images to say, but no, I don't know how I'm going to get there. Like, I have a feeling or a taste in my mouth of how I want the end to taste, and I just sort of write toward that. And it's very inefficient. I have a thing called a file called Pretty Cuts for every novel. You know, Pretty Cuts, Someone Else's Love Story, Pretty Cuts, Backseat Saints, whatever the book is. And those Pretty Cuts is everything that I've gone down wrong paths, torn out, and thrown away.
Oh.
And those, the smallest one I think I have is 47,000, almost 50,000 words. The largest one is 130,000 words I threw away.
Wow.
To write a 100,000 word book.
You literally throw it away. It's gone.
Well, I put it in the Pretty Cuts file because it's too hard to throw it away.
Okay.
Like, I can't throw it away. I like this line, you know. But okay. I think, well, I'll just put it in Pretty Cuts, and then if I need it, it'll be there. And I never need it.
Uh-huh.
But it's a trick to get me to cut out things. Like, it's safe in Pretty Cuts. I haven't really thrown it away.
Okay. Well, it's fascinating to me to hear about your process, because there's just so many different writers who use so many different approaches, and I talk to a lot of crime writers, and some of them, they know how the book's going to end, and then they try to figure out how to get there. And then you've got other ones where they have no clue who did it. They don't have no clue who committed the murder until they get about 20 or 30 pages from the end, and then they figure it out themselves. And as someone who's trying to guess as a reader, you're going, oh, I have no idea.
Well, those people kind of interest me, actually, because to be that kind of crime writer, you must presuppose that everyone in the realm of the book is capable of committing your crime.
I think you're right.
Which I kind of like that worldview. I think that's true. I think we all have dark, hidden patches inside of us. So that's very interesting to me. I think the trick is, with that kind of organic writing, is once the truth is revealed to you and once you understand it, you have a huge revision job ahead of you, making it be true on every page of the book. Otherwise, it's just cheating. Like, the truth has to be inherent. And Flannery O'Connor has that famous line about the ending should feel surprising but inevitable. Like, you're like, what? Oh, of course, it has to be this way. And I think that's right. I think she's right. I always think she's right, though. I love her.
Well, this is the first time I've had the chance to interview you, and you're extremely lively, and I see in your resume that you actually have read audiobooks. Tell us about that experience.
Well, I've always been a writer, but I didn't always write novels. I went through a long period where I was trying to write plays, and I was actually a theater major specializing in playwriting for my undergraduate degree. That's where I met my husband, actually. He was working at a black box repertory theater. And when I started writing I miss that. I would do some acting. I acted in a lot of the plays that I wrote, and I miss it. It's really fun. It's not, it's fun. It's not what I feel called to do in the way I like the writing, but I love it.
Hmm.
And reading audiobooks has sort of let me do that. I keep my hand into a thing I really love doing. And at the same time, not, you know, if you're going to be a, like I was a theater person, like a stage actor is what I really love. And, and so, cause you know, the intimacy and that is a really special thing. Live performances. Well, that's one of the reasons I like living in Atlanta so much. We do have a really good theater scene here, and I like to go sit in the audience and see plays. And so it's just sort of a way to stay connected to that world, and it's really fun. I really like it.
So do you record your own audiobooks of your
I
own?
I do. I've done okay. five of my books now.
Okay. So that must be fun.
Yes, it is. It's easier to do my own books than anyone else's, because I've already read them out loud, you know, more than once. I always read aloud because I hate it when you have those accidental iambic pentameter rhyming sentences that always seem to get in there. Or I took the groceries to the door and set them down upon the floor. Like, you don't hear that when you just read it with your eyes. You have to read it out loud to hear stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I know how everybody sounds in my head. I know where their emphasis is in the dialogue. I just know because I wrote it. So when you're reading for somebody else, it's a lot more prep work, because you have to read it quite a few times and practice scenes out loud and practice voices out loud and make decisions that you hope is what the author intended.
Gotcha. Well, it's really been fun having you on the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I've had a good time.
Jocelyn Jackson has been our guest. Her new novel is Someone Else's Love Story, and she's going to be in our area for a book signing on Monday night. She'll be at Books and Company. That's in the Green in Beaver Creek at 7 o'clock. She'll be there talking about her book, talking about her work, signing copies of her books, and all that good stuff. And you really must have fun when you get into the bookstore and actually sit down and meet your fans.
Yes. It is, it's a neat thing. You know, these are people who have either met or are about to meet my imaginary friends. And it's weird to be able to talk with flesh and blood people about people I invented as if they know them. Like that, the surrealness of that. And they sometimes have very different opinions than I do.
Uh-huh.
About, I love Paula. I know not everybody's going to love Paula. And it's going to be interesting to hear. It feels like gossip. It's illicit a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes. This past September, we had James McBride on the program again. His novel, The Good Lord Bird, is one of my favorite works of fiction from this past year. And apparently, I wasn't alone in my view of this wonderful book. James McBride has just won the National Book Award for The Good Lord Bird. And in honor of this fact and James McBride, next week, we're going to bring you that interview again. James McBride with The Good Lord Bird, winner of the National Book Award. The Book Nook is recorded at Soundspace in Yellow Springs and engineered by Chris Hertzler.